From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Over 40 million Americans don't have health insurance, and many of those who do are not happy with their coverage. On today's Fresh Air, suggestions for fixing health insurance. First, we talk with Dr. Marcia Angel and Dr. Quentin Young of Physicians for a National Health Program. They advocate a single-payer plan. Then we'll get an overview of some other options from Dr. Karen Davis. She's on the Institute of Medicine's committee proposing options for medical reform. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The choice of Jon Snow to replace fired Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill was made official today. The White House confirmed it has nominated the chairman of the railroad conglomerate CSX to serve as the new point person on its economic team. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Snow's last political ties to Washington held back to the Ford administration, where he served as Deputy Undersecretary of Transportation. While a wide variety of names were initially discussed, there had been no mention of the 63-year-old CSX chairman, making the nomination something of a surprise. But White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said Snow was the president's choice for several reasons.
I think it was all the reasons that the president outlined in his statement, the experience that Mr. Snow has, the expertise he has, the wide respect that he has. Those are all the factors that led to the president's conclusion to nominate him.
Snow, who has a Ph.D. in economics and a law degree, has also served as chairman of the Business Roundtable, a group comprised of chief executives of large companies. Snow has strong ties to the GOP. The nomination still must be confirmed by the Senate. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
United Airlines is bracing for sharp labor cuts. It filed for bankruptcy protection today as it struggles to curb daily losses of about $20 million. But the nation's number two carrier says it intends to keep flying, and a spokesman for the airline's pilots, Captain Herb Hunter, says the company's employees are trying to look to the future.
The employees are going to keep coming to work, and folks out there, United employees, we're going to keep getting our paychecks, and things are going to move on. Our passengers, we're going to be flying tomorrow, we're going to be flying next week, we're going to be flying next month, and we're going to come through this better. It is painful now. It breaks my heart. I had this sick ache in my stomach this morning when I heard the final announcement.
Hunter and other United employees and executives are facing new salary cuts, and United CEO says he may consider selling off some of the airline's assets. Delegates representing unionized dock workers are meeting in San Francisco to figure out if they'll back a tentative labor agreement with shipping carriers. A contract would end a heated labor dispute that prompted dock worker lockouts at West Coast ports for nearly 2 weeks. Union spokesman Steve Stallone says one of the big sticking points is the introduction of new technology.
Who would operate that technology? Would union workers do that work, or would the employers use the technology as a way to outsource the actual work? The agreement that we have has language that says those jobs will be union jobs.
Union delegates are expected to decide this Friday whether to recommend the contract's passage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 172 points at 8,473. The Nasdaq was down 55 points. The S&P 500 also down 20 points. This is NPR News in Washington. The White House is praising a federal judge's decision to throw out a lawsuit against Vice President Dick Cheney. The General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, sought information on how the White House developed its energy policy and wanted the identities of energy executives and lobbyists that consulted with Mr. Cheney's task force. North Carolina's governor wants his state declared a federal disaster area. 12 deaths in North Carolina are blamed on last week's ice storm, and more than a half million homes in the region don't have electricity. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports from Raleigh.
Governor Mike Easley says North Carolina suffered millions of dollars in damage from the storm. At its peak, about 2 million people lost their electric service, and some are not expected to get it back until the middle of the week. Utility companies have brought line crews in from about a dozen other states to help repair damage, and Governor Easley is urging residents to be patient.
I want to keep this entire state focused on the fact that help is on the way. I think that's important. I think it boosts the morale not only of the line crews, but of the people.
State officials also are urging North Carolinians to be careful as they struggle to heat their homes without electricity. Several people have died from carbon monoxide poisoning after using charcoal grills or kerosene heaters indoors. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
NASA is sending up its first Israeli astronaut into space next month. Ilan Ramon, who's with Israel's Air Force, will work with six Americans in a 16-day science research mission. The January launch is expected to take place amid tighter than usual security. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If it weren't for the steady beat of war drums, healthcare would be front and center in the political debate, according to Dr. Marcia Angel. She's the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine and is a senior lecturer in social medicine at Harvard Medical School. Many doctors and patients agree that our healthcare insurance system is inadequate and dysfunctional. Today we're going to talk about possible ways of fixing it. First, we'll discuss the single-payer plan, which Dr. Angel advocates. She's the head of the Physicians Working Group, which was founded by the Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of more than 10,000 physicians who support single-payer national health insurance. Also with us is Dr. Quentin Young. He's the national coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program. He's also a practicing internist and a clinical professor of preventive medicine and community health at the University of Illinois Medical Center. I asked Dr. Young to describe some of the problems he and his colleagues face within the current healthcare system.
Well, there are a number of major problems, starting first with the enormous bureaucracy I have to penetrate each day of work, a bureaucracy of paper and people at the end of the phone giving you permission or denying you permission to do things you need for your patient. There's been an interposition of corporate interests into my very consultation room, which is awful. Beyond that, of course, we have people who don't have the resources, private resources, to get the medication or get the tests that are indicated. That's always a huge strain on a doctor trying to do his best for the patients. Beyond that, you have, and this is probably the harshest criticism I can make, the terms of engagement in the consultation room where the patient and doctor are attempting to solve the patient's problem have been changed. And from a prevailing mood of optimism and hope and confidence and affection, it's been slowly but steadily transformed into one of mistrust, hostility, and even rage. That is inimical to good healthcare events, and I feel that the standard of health in this country faces a decline because of this widespread reality in American medicine practice.
What kind of practice are you in? Do you belong to an HMO or group practice?
I'm a general internal medicine doctor, a primary care doctor, if you please. I'm in a group of eight doctors, all of them wonderful, younger than me doctors. And we practice in a community in Chicago, where I started some 50 years ago. I myself am not in any of these HMOs, some of my colleagues do belong to these arrangements. And it's an everyday experience to see how that impinges. Let me give one example of the huge waste. We have about 13 full-time equivalents to service we eight doctors, nurses, technicians, clerical. Fully five of those people are doing nothing but pushing paper to keep the practice afloat, to communicate with the various 1,600 insurance companies. That's how many we have. And when we say single payer, if I may make the definition right now, we speak about one insurance company, which is what we have practically for Medicare, our system for the elderly, which is flawed, but is so much better than the reality for the rest of us who are not in the over 65 government insurance plan. So I see it every day, Terry, in our practice, and it's oppressive, it's confounding, it's and it really detracts from our ability to give care.
Dr. Angel, you've said if we had set out to design the worst system that we could imagine, we couldn't have imagined one as bad as we have. One or two compelling examples of what makes our current system so bad, in your judgment.
Too few Americans have access to comprehensive health care. In fact, most of us don't have access to comprehensive health care, even when we have what's considered a fairly good insurance policy. So the employers pay a portion, an increasingly small portion, of the premium to health care businesses, largely investor-owned managed care plans. And here the deal is that the managed care plans cover all of the enrollees in the particular workplace for a year for a set premium. And if they can cover these people for less than that premium, they get to keep whatever is left over. And if it costs them for the medical services more than the premiums, then they lose money and they have to raise the premiums the next year. So here there's an incentive not to provide medical care. And indeed, these managed care companies, these for-profit managed care companies, talk about the medical services they have to provide as a medical loss ratio. And they brag to their investors how low they can keep that. Some of them will brag that they have a medical loss ratio of only 70%, which means that 30% of the health care dollar is kept for administrative costs, for marketing expenses, and for profits. So you can see that the way they gain is by providing fewer and fewer medical services. Doctors now work for these companies, and in a sense, doctors are becoming double agents. On the one hand, they're supposedly agents for their patients, as the Hippocratic Oath requires them to be, and as thousands of years of history requires them to be. But on the other hand, we now find them being agents for their employers, the managed care administrators, who are pressuring them to do less and less and less for their patients.
Now, you're both advocating a single-payer plan. What does that mean, Dr. Angel?
Well, it means that the funds, the financing of health care, goes through a central agency. In the case of Medicare, for example, it's the Medicare and Medicaid, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It goes through a central agency so that it can be distributed rationally and coordinated. And that is very, very much more efficient and cost-effective. If you look at Medicare, which is a single-payer system embedded within our larger market-based system, if you look at Medicare, its overhead costs are about 2%. Compare that with the private health insurance market, where the overhead costs right off the top. Now, there are more overhead costs as you go downstream. As Dr. Young said in his office, there's plenty of overhead costs. But right off the top, the managed care plans cream off for marketing, administrative costs, and profits on the order of 10 to 25%, 10 times as much as Medicare takes.
Dr. Young, is the single-payer plan that your group is advocating based on a plan that another country already follows?
Well, it turns out that every other country in the world that resembles us in the sense that they have an advanced industrial base and a democratic system of one form or another, every country, whether you're speaking of Western Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, Japan, has over the centuries, the first one was Germany in 1886, and the most recent one, believe it or not, is Thailand just last year. Every country has come to the conclusion that healthcare is so important to the society that it's the responsibility of that society to guarantee access to decent healthcare. That's in the national interest. That makes for a healthier population, a better workforce, and just a more congenial environment. And what we've been describing, the kind of struggle to get care and the disappointment, and indeed, we haven't even mentioned the bankruptcy The number one cause of personal bankruptcy is unpaid medical bills in this country that expends twice as much as any other country each year on health care. Well, these countries have learned that by this one reform, and each country differs a little bit, and ours will differ from every other country. If for no other reason, we have so much more resource to start with. Imagine having more than twice as much as most countries per capita to spend on health care. And instead of squandering it the way we do now, we would cover everybody and begin to use, and this is a very important concept, the best of modern medical science, best practices, population-based decisions, a new emphasis on prevention. And we could change the character of illness in our aging population and the experience with illness by having a system that ended the economic barriers.
The underlying problem is that we are the only advanced country that treats health care as a market commodity to be distributed according to the ability to pay, and not as a social service to be distributed according to medical need. That is the fundamental problem. And so we differ from every other country in the extent to which health care funds are diverted to overhead and profits.
My guests are Dr. Marcia Angel and Dr. Quentin Young of Physicians for a National Health Program. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dr. Marcia Angel and Dr. Quentin Young of Physicians for a National Health Program, a group which advocates reforming our health insurance system by instituting a single-payer plan. What would a single-payer system mean for consumers on a practical basis?
Well, on a practical basis, they would have a right to comprehensive health care. Now, the package of health care could be designed in different ways. Medicare, which, as I've said, is the single-payer system, is not perfect. It doesn't cover everything. It doesn't cover prescription drugs, outpatient prescription drugs, and it should. It doesn't cover long-term care. It could. You could change Medicare in those ways, and I think that it should be, although the prices would have to be regulated. But you would design a system of benefits, and everyone would have a right to that. You wouldn't be giving them a voucher or giving them $1,000 to go out in the insurance market and buy whatever they could get for it. They would have a right to all of those services, and they would be paid for from the first dollar. There would be no deductibles, no co-payments. The way you would pay for it could differ. The other countries, all of which, the other advanced countries, have single-payer systems, collect the money in different ways, some of them from employers, some of them, as in Canada, directly from taxes, income taxes. Medicare here is payroll taxes. You could have the money come from a variety of sources, but the important thing is that it would be administered, it would be distributed and coordinated through one source. We now pay for our health care. We pay probably twice as much as we should in multiple ways. In a sense, we're nickeled and dimed. We pay for it through our paychecks, through the prices of goods and services, through taxes at all levels of government, city, state, and federal. We pay for it increasingly out of pocket through deductibles and co-payments. So we already pay for it, and we pay in spades in many different ways. A single-payer system that makes the most sense. You would pay for it just once, and the most progressive way would be through an earmarked tax on income. but the total would be less.
There are so many Americans who are distrustful of the American government's ability to run a system, or, you know, particularly suspicious of government bureaucracies. So yes. If the healthcare system was basically put in the hands of a government-run bureaucracy, are you confident, Dr. Young, that that bureaucracy would be any better than the bureaucracies you face now?
Well, that's a very important question. Those of us who are advocates know that you can't have a conversation before the issue of government and taxes is raised. And ideologically, the conservative view that we need no government and we should cut all taxes is very powerful. But I find that almost an irrational position. First of all, our experience with government medicine is excellent. Let me give a few examples. The National Institutes of Health are a purely federal project, which is the envy of the world for distributing billions of dollars in research, and arguably the American predominance in the field of bioscience is based on that federal project called the National Institutes of Health. A few other examples. Medicare has been mentioned. It's flawed. Those flaws could be removed. I speak of the absence of a decent pharmaceutical benefit, the absence of long-term care, and not enough money in place for mental health needs. But those are easily remedied because of the vast amounts of money we have. Think also, if you talk government medicine, of our public health system, which in turn is undernourished, but nevertheless is our bulwark, all the more vividly dramatized in this period of bioterrorism. Our public health system is a defense of our nation, and it's public, government, tax-driven arrangement.
Now, your group, Physicians for a National Health Program, is advocating for a single-payer medical plan in the United States. One of the obstacles you would have to overcome to make that happen is dealing with all the medical insurance companies in the United States, who would, of course, object to a single-payer system because it means that their business would be out of business. They'd no longer be necessary. Do you think it's even conceivable in the United States that a single-payer system would be seriously contemplated, given the amount of power that the insurance industry has?
That's a very pertinent question. The power is enormous. I would put it in terms of having corrupted our political process. The amounts of money the drug companies and the HMO organizations spend in winning congressional favor is obscene. And there's no denying a serious discussion of this reform bumps into the question, is it politically feasible? With many people who are even congenial to the idea saying that can't happen. My argument is that it must happen. Unless we reform our system, we will have an ever-increasing inequity here, which will be defined in terms of human suffering and early death. And that's beginning to happen. And that the American people won't stand for. We've had, Terry, equivalent mountains to climb. I'm old enough to remember the civil rights movement, which grew out of the legalized segregation and denial of voters' rights and other rights to people of black complexion. In 1950, which is like where we are now in the health system, people who felt this was unfair also felt there was no way to overcome the power of those who profited from the segregated system. And in a relatively short time, this country's capacity to meet great challenges was fulfilled.
I'm going to stop you. Are you suggesting that there needs to be some kind of mass movement, the equivalent of the civil rights movement, with protests and demonstrations, and in order for there to be change? Is that the way you see it happening?
I think that'll be part of it. That's the way this country works. We have freedoms, and we exploit them to change. That's the glory of this country. And the answer to your question is yes. I believe that that's happening more and more. We see medical students. The American Medical Student Association holds twilight vigils all over this country. I've been to a half a dozen of them myself. These are medical students, the future doctors, saying we want a decent system. And I would point to Al Gore, the man who got the popular vote in the last election, who for up until his recent pronouncement was not a supporter of single-payer, said he's come to the conclusion, as he put it reluctantly, that it's the way we have to go. Well, that, if you're talking about political feasibility, if the premier leader, so to speak, of one of the two parties says he feels it's necessary, I think we have a different term of engagement.
The National Academy of Sciences is recommending that the Bush administration sponsor demonstration projects in five different areas of medical health so that new kinds of programs could be tested and then expanded if they succeed. And these areas include tax credits, expanding Medicaid and children's health insurance, alternatives to medical malpractice litigation, and so on. What do you think of that approach?
Well, let me say, I talked to the chair of that committee, who happened to be an old friend, Mr. Gail Warden, and I congratulated him on this prestigious committee's recommendation for experimentation and told him, as you know, all of the proposals that you're making are doomed to failure. Because these partial measures are exactly the problem we have. It's the multi-payer, patch quilt, jigsaw puzzle arrangement that is the burden on the American people. While I welcome this obviously important statement from a very prestigious source, at the same moment, we've done the experiment. The last 20 years has been a catastrophic event for the American people, a trial of for-profit, market-driven arrangements that has brought great suffering and is now in its final throes of failure. Employers, who are the heartblood of the market system, are offloading their responsibilities to employees. They're either cutting the benefits or not covering the family or letting the worker pay for the premium. All of these systems are obviously not the answer to the problem. And I really want to emphasize the glory part of our message. We have the resources to fix the problem. We just have to get as smart as many other countries in allocating these wonderful resources.
Dr. Young, Dr. Angel, thank you both so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, as usual,
thank
Terry.
Thank you,
wonderful
yes.
interview.
Dr. Marcia Angel and Dr. Quentin Young of Physicians for a National Health Program, which advocates reforming health insurance by instituting a single-payer plan. More options for reforming health insurance in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more options for reforming our health insurance system. We talk with Karen Davis, a health policy expert who's on the Institute of Medicine's committee studying ways to improve health care. And Ken Tucker reviews the debut CD by white British rapper Mike Skinner, also known as The Streets. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about ways to reform our health insurance system. My guest, Karen Davis, is an economist and health policy expert who's on the Institute of Medicine's committee investigating ways to improve the healthcare system. She's president of the Commonwealth Fund, a national philanthropy engaged in research on health and social policy issues. She's the former chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health, and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health Policy in the Department of Health and Human Services from 1977 to 1980. I asked her what she thinks are some of the best options for making health insurance available and accessible to everyone.
Well, there are a number of options out there. There are some people who support a single-payer system similar to the Canadian system, or perhaps expanding our Medicare program for the elderly to cover everyone. President Bush has a different proposal on the table, which is to give people tax credits to buy individual health insurance on their own. And there are other options of building on our current system, which is basically an employer-based system of private health insurance coverage, and looking at ways of expanding that, as well as expanding public programs such as Medicare and our children's health insurance program that covers low-income children.
Be interested. You've been studying this for a long time, so I'd be interested in hearing your opinions on some of these options. Let's start with the single-payer plan. Do you think that that's a workable option?
I think it has strong features. It certainly would cover everybody. It would be very simple. And there is evidence that it would be efficient. The difficulty with it is that it really requires a huge increase in federal taxes to finance it. Currently, employers are spending $350 billion on health care. If you dropped that and went to a single-payer system, the federal government would have to pick that up. So I think in our current economic and budgetary climate, it's really not very realistic to think about single-payer in today's times.
Here's what I'm wondering. You know, a lot of people say, I don't want my taxes raised. On the other hand, everybody seems to be complaining bitterly about the healthcare system, the expense of healthcare insurance. A lot of people are uninsured. If it was put to people, well, look, your taxes are going to go up. On the other hand, you're going to be guaranteed decent healthcare, you know, for the rest of your life, and so will your family. Do you think that they might go for the higher taxes?
Well, I think people value health care very highly, and I think they would be willing to pay both higher taxes and contribute toward their own health insurance coverage. But you have to have amounts that are affordable for people. And the real problem with the 41 million uninsured is they really can't afford to purchase health insurance on their own. And there are about 30 million people who are underinsured who, even though they have insurance, it's really inadequate to help them pay their medical bills. So I think the most realistic approach is one that would really get contributions from everyone. It would have employers contribute to health insurance coverage. It would have working families contribute a part of the premium, a part of the expenses, and it would have taxpayers providing assistance for those who particularly have low incomes or are very sick or disabled and really couldn't afford to pay for their own insurance or their own care.
But in answer to that question of, you know, if it was put to the public, yes, your taxes would go up, but you would be guaranteed of good health care and so would your family. Do you think that they might choose to have the higher taxes and a single-payer system?
I think Americans would be willing to pay higher taxes or to forgo tax cuts that are currently on the books. I don't think people really understand the tax cut that was enacted in 2001. They think about their $300 or $600 tax rebate and think that's what the tax cut was about. But there are many tax cuts that are scheduled to take place over the next few years. In 2004, everybody's taxes will go down by one percentage point. So if they're in a 29% bracket, it'd go down to 28. If they're in a 15% bracket, it'd go down to 14. So one option would be simply to forgo some tax cuts that are on the books to take place in January of 2004 or January of 2007. And I think many Americans would be willing to forgo that. If you forgo just one of those, that would generate $40 billion a year in federal revenues that could be used to really fill the gaps in health insurance coverage.
Let's look at the tax credits option. This is the option favored by President Bush. What exactly would that mean? What's an example of how that might work?
President Bush's proposal, for example, for an individual would provide $1,000 that you could write off of your taxes, or if you didn't owe taxes, you'd actually get $1,000 in cash to go out and buy your own health insurance policy. And that might work reasonably well for a healthy young person where when they go to buy health insurance, they might find a premium of $2,000, $2,500. For a person age 60, when they go to find a health insurance policy on their own, the premium is going to be $6,000. And that's if they don't have a health problem. If they haven't had cancer, they don't have heart disease, haven't had a stroke, don't have diabetes. So tax credits really, it's one thing to say a tax credit, but there are two problems with it. Is it enough money to really make the insurance affordable? And two, can you really buy coverage if you've got a pre-existing health condition? And that's not the case for many people.
Well, you've just gotten to a real paradox in the healthcare system. Because the healthcare system and because the health insurance companies and the HMOs are profit-oriented systems, if you're sick, no one really is enthusiastic about insuring you because you're going to cost them a lot of money. And if you're trying to get insurance and you're sick, you're going to find it hard to get.
That's right. And that's why I think the real secret here is group health insurance rather than people's buying insurance on their own. And one mechanism we have now, most employers do provide health insurance to their workers. Now, some workers can't afford to pick up even their share of the premium. So the federal government could do more to provide some premium assistance to those low-wage workers. And some employers, particularly small businesses, don't offer health insurance to their workers because they find the premiums high. Well, the government, either the federal government or state governments, could reinsure coverage to protect them against having a particular worker or dependent with high cost driving up premiums. So there are ways of making health insurance options available to small employers and lowering those premiums to make them more affordable by providing premium assistance and by providing some form of what's called reinsurance or stop loss coverage to protect against catastrophic expenses.
One thing critics might say of that plan is it's creating an even bigger bureaucracy because it's adding state bureaucracies into the HMO and health insurance bureaucracies that already exist. It's expanding an already confusing system. There's a lot of critics of the so-called patchwork approach to reforming the healthcare system.
That's right. I think we need a seamless healthcare system. We need some way of automatically assigning people to health insurance coverage. And there are mechanisms, for example, electronic insurance clearinghouses were recently recommended by an Institute of Medicine report committee on which I served to really make it much easier for people to get enrolled in insurance or if they lose insurance because they change a job, to make sure that they actually stay in some insurance system through an electronic insurance clearinghouse. So I think we do need to make the current system simpler. I think modern information technology has a lot of promise to help do that, as well as achieve economies in the administration of insurance.
But wouldn't that still be creating like a new bureaucracy if we're adding a new type of insurance for the people who are unemployed? I mean, thank goodness they'd have insurance, but still for the medical system, is it further complicating and bureaucratizing it?
Well, I think it's important that we build on what exists, because anytime you take something that's brand new, it's very complicated. So what I would do at the federal level is take the plan that now covers members of Congress, a congressional health plan, if you want to call it that, and open that up to small businesses and individuals rather than creating something totally new. We know how that works. There are 170 different health insurance plans that participate in that. It's very good coverage, and really make that more widely available throughout the country.
So what would that mean for individuals? How would you get access to it?
Well, there are different ways that it could be done. Again, I think it would be good to have internet administration, so a small business that wanted to sign up could go on the internet and say, I'd like to enroll these employees and hear their Social Security numbers and pay their premiums over the internet. So that's one way it could work. Another way it could work is really through the income tax system, just really checking off on the income tax system that you're uninsured and getting your enrollment package, just as a federal employee now gets an enrollment package with a list of choices. So I think there are ways of doing it. I think the most difficult problem is really, though, with what we touched on before, people who are very disabled, very sick, really not in a position to afford much in the way of a health insurance premium. And for those people, I think expanding public programs really makes sense. Currently, with our Medicare program, we make the disabled wait 2 years before they qualify for coverage. So if you have MS or if you have some other kind of disabling condition like a major stroke, we really ought to just cover those people right away. In addition, there are a lot of people over age 55, over age 60 who are uninsured. Letting them buy into the Medicare program early, it's a program that exists, and they're going to be on it at age 65. So I think there are things we can do to pick up different groups of people by building on the Medicare program. And states do have in place now a very effective program for low-income children. Each state has its own name, but it's basically a children's health insurance program. Certainly that could be expanded to cover parents, to cover other kinds of low-income childless adults.
My guest is health policy expert Karen Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about options for reforming our health insurance system. My guest, Karen Davis, is one of the health policy experts on the Institute of Medicine's panel investigating ways to improve health care. She's also the president of the Commonwealth Fund, which researches health and social policy issues. Now, you're on the committee organized by the Institute of Medicine to create demonstration projects to reform the health care system. What's the demonstration project going to be like regarding health insurance?
Well, this is to test out some new approaches to providing health insurance. I think, quite frankly, from my point of view, people are frustrated by the gridlock in Washington and starting to turn to states to really provide some innovation and really move us forward and to tackle this problem because we're really not making much headway. So what the Institute of Medicine report recommended is that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issue a proposal to states and say, we're willing to fund 3 to 5 states for 10 years to cover virtually everybody in the state if you come forward with some good ideas about how you might do it. And the Institute of Medicine Committee recommended 2 strategies to test out tax credits and to see if that works, perhaps using the state's income tax system, or to expand public programs such as Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, to cover every uninsured person in the state, or perhaps to provide a combination of approaches that would help small businesses have options for providing health insurance coverage, as well as expanding public programs, including expanding the Medicare program. In addition, the Institute of Medicine recommended that the state set up an electronic insurance clearinghouse. First of all, when you go to the doctor's office, the doctor could check what insurance coverage you have. And if you don't have insurance coverage, they could then help you get signed up right there over the internet with a form of health insurance coverage that works for you and your family. So the Institute of Medicine is really recommending that we turn to states for a leadership role and to test out some of these ideas and really see if this won't generate universal health insurance coverage for the state, provide stable health insurance coverage, and to try to make some changes in the healthcare system that would promote efficiency. For example, just having people pick out a doctor that they would go to so they wouldn't use emergency rooms, and to have that doctor responsible for making sure they're getting regular preventive care. If they've got diabetes or asthma, that those conditions be well-maintained, and really to stick with the doctor, because what we know, if you keep the same insurance coverage over time, you keep the same doctor, you get to know that doctor. In fact, they can do a good job at keeping you healthy and keep costs down in the long run.
Now, we've been focusing on the availability and affordability of health insurance, but let me ask you something about the current health insurance options that exist now. I'm referring specifically to for-profit HMOs. There have been a lot of complaints, both by doctors and patients, that HMOs that are profit-making have to report to their shareholders and make a profit. Therefore, they often overrule doctors when doctors want to give their patient an expensive test or procedure. The bureaucracy within health insurance companies and HMOs is so expensive that a lot of the healthcare dollar that we spend really goes to fund the bureaucracy. What do you think of these critiques of existing health insurance?
I think the U.S. experience with managed care over the last decade has been very disappointing, and it really has not delivered on the promise that was held out when we embarked on shifting large numbers of people into managed care plans. I think people who advocated that approach had in mind the nonprofit group and staff model, health maintenance organizations like Kaiser Permanente that have produced high-quality care and really been able to satisfy a lot of patients. But instead, what came into the industry, as you mentioned, were for-profit companies that were more interested in getting discounts from hospitals and doctors and denying many claims requiring people to get prior approval for all kinds of services. And that wasn't based on any kind of scientific evidence of what was best for patients or the kind of care that they really needed or what was necessary versus unnecessary care. And it drove up administrative costs. We certainly know that many of those managed care plans had administrative costs that were 15 to 20%. So that a lot of the healthcare dollar, instead of going for health care, really went for this kind of overhead. And I think we've now seen a movement away from those forms of managed care plans.
Two of the guests I was speaking to earlier who advocate the single-payer system, they think that is what is required right now is a mass movement of Americans rising up in demonstrations to say, we need a new system. This isn't working. You must fix it. Would you like to see that? Do you expect that to happen?
Well, I think people are concerned, but I don't think that concerns well orchestrated or being heard. So I think letting people in positions of influence know that healthcare really matters to Americans is important. But I think we do a lot of surveys of people mm-hmm. and really ask them, what do you want? And when we ask people if they want to give up their current coverage and move into a new system, a new kind of government-run system, most people don't want that. They want to keep what they have. So the real problems are those people who don't have health insurance coverage, those who don't have good coverage, those who want improved coverage, or they want prescription drugs if they're elderly, they want lower premiums if they're working. So I think people are concerned about health care. I'm not sure there's universal support for just totally junking and scrapping what we have now. I think people are very nervous about that. And anytime you start talking about taking away the coverage they have now and giving them something new and untried, I think people have a lot of qualms about that. So I think you're far better off saying, let's build on what works. For people who have good coverage, let's just help them keep it. Let's help them keep it when they become unemployed, make sure that they can still hold on to their employer health insurance coverage. And let's help everybody who's working get access to the kind of coverage that those workers with better jobs now have. So I wouldn't totally scrap what we have. I don't think it's realistic given our current economic and budget consideration. And I really don't think there's broad-based support for it.
Karen Davis, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my delight to be here.
Karen Davis is the president of the Commonwealth Fund and is on the Institute of Medicine's panel investigating ways to improve health care. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the white British rapper who records under the name The Streets. This is Fresh Air. Mike Skinner is a 23-year-old from Birmingham, England, who records under the name The Streets. His debut collection, called Original Pirate Material, was recorded in the basement of his mother's home. But rock critic Ken Tucker says it sounds anything but primitive or amateurish.
Has it come to this? Oh. Original pirate material. You're listening to The Streets. Lock down your aerial. Has it come to this? Original pirate material. You're listening to The Streets. Lock down your aerial. Make yourself at home. We got diesel or some of that homegrown. Sit back in your throne. Turn off your phone, because this is our zone. Videos, televisions, 64s, PlayStations. Web Henry with precision. A few herbs and a bit of Benson. But don't forget the Rizzler. Lean like the Tower of Pisa. These are Oasia, and this is a day in the life of a geezer. For this
over the course of the 13 tracks on original pirate material, Mike Skinner, in a thick Birmingham accent, describes what he repeatedly refers to as a day in the life of a geezer. And by geezer, he means a young fellow like himself, a guy who likes to drink beer, smoke some pot, hang out with his mates, and here's one way he's distinctive, fall in love with an unabashed intensity that's rare among boasting blokes like this.
This ain't the damn, it's the upbeat, make it complete. So what's the story? Guaranteed accuracy, enhanced CD. Latest technology, darts at treble 20. Huge non-recoupable advance, majors be vigilant. I excel in both content and deliverance. So let's put on our classics and we'll have a little dance, shall we? No sales pitch, no media.
That's Mike Skinner. Sorry, Mike, but I just can't bring myself to call you by your preferred recording name, The Streets, even though I don't doubt you come from them, and from the sound of it, probably still spend a lot of time on them. Indeed, it's this English matiness of Mike Skinner that provides him with so many good lines about eating junk food, drinking, getting in arguments and fights. The Streets, and here I mean the streets of Birmingham, have given Mike Skinner the material for a series of character sketches on a tune like The Irony of It All.
Hello! Hello! My name's Terry and I'm a law abider. There's nothing I like more than getting fired up on beer. And when the weekend's here, I exercise my right to get paralytic and fight. Good bloke, fairly, but I get well leery when geezers look at me funny. Bouncing around like bunnies. I'm likely to cause mischief. Good clean grief, you must believe, and I ain't no thief. Law abiding and all legal. And who cares about my liver when it feels good? What you need's some real manhood. Rasher, burning casher. Putting people's backs up. Public disorder, I give you public disorder. I down 8 pints and run all over the place. Spit in the face of an officer. See if that bothers you. Cause I never broke a law in my life. Someday I'm gonna settle down with a wife. Go on, lads, let's have another fight.
My name's Tim and I'm a criminal.
You may have noticed by now that Mike Skinner doesn't rap like American hip-hoppers do. And as a white guy, he doesn't mimic African-American speech patterns as, say, Eminem does. Skinner, using simple, looping rhythm tracks, rhymes both with and against the beat in a refreshingly novel way. His timing is different and striking. Skinner is also much more of a romantic than most popular rappers, as you can hear on this dreamily intense composition, It's Too Late.
She said, meet me at the gates at 8. Leave now, don't be late. She said one day she'd walk away, cause I was always late. Thought things were okay. Didn't care though anyway. Say sorry babe, I had to meet a mate, tempting fate. We first met through a shared view, she loved me and I did too. It's now 7:50, getting ready, better be nifty. Do my hair quickly, step out, it's cloudy. Mate bells me to borrow money, I got 2 Henrys and a dealer to pay. Call up on geezers to rid these green trees of my reeking jeans. Gotta you think I care, air out glaring geezer stares. I'm here and I'm there. Couldn't see past the end of my beer. What was getting near, or the silence after the cheers. I didn't know it was over.
Over the course of this CD, Mike Skinner comes across as a stubborn, proud, but sensitive guy. At one point, talking about a crush, he remarks, once bitten, forever smitten. At another point, he says punningly, I excel at both content and deliverance. And later he says, this ain't a track, it's a movement. I hope Mike Skinner really hasn't started a movement. It would be just a feeble imitation of his distinctive haranguing, an original voice.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Original Pirate Material by The Streets. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by jazz pianist and composer Mal Waldron. He died a week ago at the age of 77 of cancer. Here's his 1961 recording of his composition Warm Canto with Eric Dolphy on clarinet.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans, their families, and communities with financial strategies and customer-focused service, online at thrivent.com, and Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The U.S. is relying on Pakistan to be an ally in the war against terrorism, but Islamic extremists gain power in two areas along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Owen Bennett Jones, author of the book Pakistan, Eye of the Storm. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.